Excessive heat caused an increase in overall humidity levels, leading to an increase in monsoon rainfalls up to 3 times the average recorded in the past 30 years. On the other hand, the record-breaking heat waves initiated glacial meltdowns in the Himalayan mountains that streamed into Pakistan's north. Statistics show that Pakistan is responsible for less than 1% of total global carbon emissions. In fact, Pakistan is responsible for 0.4% of global carbon emissions since 1959. Meanwhile, wealthy developed countries which consume most of the fossil fuel reserves, like the U.S. and China, have the highest share of carbon emissions, amounting to roughly 21.5% and 16.4%, respectively. The resulting flood from environmental changes has almost destroyed the most important sector in Pakistan's economy. Agriculture makes up about a quarter of the country's GDP, while nearly 40% of the workforce is employed in this sector or related professions. With the loss of millions of acres of farms, it's safe to say that Pakistan's agriculture is facing an apocalypse. Once a major exporter of agricultural products, Pakistan should now consider imports.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Athar Hussain, the head of the Center for Climate Research and Development in Islamabad. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Hussain. Now, this year's floods in Pakistan are unprecedented, as nearly a third of Pakistan has been submerged in water. So why is this happening to Pakistan despite its relatively small share of global carbon emissions?
Yeah, that's right. The share of the carbon dioxide emission from Pakistan is less than 1%. But the problem is that as soon as the carbon dioxide goes in the atmosphere, it doesn't care where from it is coming. So it gets spread out equally. So as a result, the temperature rises practically everywhere on the surface of the earth. And since the geography and the terrain of Pakistan is such that it has not high mountains in the north and Arabian Sea in the south. So this provides a very effective combination for any change in the climate to disrupt the normal monsoon pattern. So this is the reason that this year several combination of weather patterns work together to produce a more than above normal rainfall in the monsoon period.
So, Mr. Hussain, why haven't we seen the same enthusiasm for humanitarian aid to disaster-struck countries in the subcontinent region as we saw in the case of Ukraine?
Well, I have seen many examples, such as we ourselves contributed towards the flood relief camp. And secondly, several Islamic countries started it in the very first moments when the call came out from the government of Pakistan, such as UAE, Turkey, and other nations then joined the hands. There is, of course, it is less than what is required, but the aid is pouring in. And even today I heard that, see the news that UN has sent 4 planes of supply to support the needed.
Mr. Hussain, how can relief operations take place in such widespread flooding when supposedly administrative and emergency response buildings are also underwater?
Well, then we have the supply from the dropping from the helicopters and other similar support systems to support the persons. And in nearby areas where there is no devastation due to flood, the government system is working, and then up to that point the support is available by land, and then it is by through the boats and other support system that can run over the water.
Last but not least, Mr. Hussain, what can the rest of the world do to deal with climate change and rising temperatures that cause the glacial meltdowns? And also, is there hope to prevent such disasters from happening in the future?
Yeah, this is now more and more demanding collective wisdom from all of us. The culprit for the rise in temperature is the anthropogenic increase in the carbon dioxide. So as soon as we start thinking more seriously and collaborating with each other, the amount of carbon should have to be reduced that is going into the atmosphere. And then as a result, the temperature will be rising less slowly, and as a result, these significant climate changes that are occurring will be occurring at a much lower space and speed as they were occurring previously. And these, for which the different capacity persons can be adjusted, can be made adaptable to these non-significant climate changes. This is a situation which is demanding a lot of collaboration, and more efforts need to be done in terms of doing the regional climate modeling so that we understand better the changing patterns, and also the planning on behalf of the regional government so that such large-scale devastations can be minimized.
There you have it, Mr. Hussain, the head of the Center for Climate Research and Development at Islamabad campus. Thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Member of the British Parliament for Leicester East, Claudia Webb, pointed to the climate catastrophe in the country by mentioning the recent floods, wildfires, and melting glaciers. She asked for cancelling the country's debt and paying the country the climate compensation. Former Prime Minister of Islamic Republic of Pakistan, Imran Khan, stated that the people need to understand the disastrous impact of global climate change and warn against imperative changes the country is making to the environment. Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, Karachi-based artist, asked for cancellation of the Pakistan debt in an interview with MSNBC channel, warning that otherwise people will starve.
You're listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Sri Lanka has been grappling with crippling inflation, currency devaluation, shortage of fuel and food supplies, and unparalleled social unrest for months. It's now suffering from its worst financial crisis since its independence from Britain in 1948. Cash flow insolvency has forced the government to once again ask for financial assistance from the IMF. An act that could satisfy previous creditors but could lead to unpleasant consequences for the South Asian nation.
Sri Lanka is experiencing another cash flow problem with its economy trapped in a downward spiral. Since the beginning of March 2022, Sri Lankan rupee has devalued against the US dollar by roughly 45%. Its currency reserves are almost depleted with less than $1 billion. Meanwhile, the island nation is expected to return $4 billion U.S. dollars worth of debt in the final quarter of 2022, including $1 billion of international sovereign bonds that were supposed to be repaid by January 2022. Sri Lanka's foreign debt stands at a staggering $51 billion U.S. dollars, and most of it is owed to multilateral creditors and government bonds. This debt has expanded in recent years due to tax reductions and irresponsible expenditure on major infrastructural projects. The final blow was the COVID-19 pandemic, which deprived the country of billions of dollars in foreign remittance and tourism income. This predicament has forced the Sri Lankan government to request an emergency loan of $2.9 billion U.S. dollars, which is still pending a final verification by the IMF Board of Directors. The agreement mandates major reforms in the country's economy in order to decrease financial deficits. It also includes agreements with creditors such as Japan, China, and India to extend the repayment deadlines for the country's astronomical foreign debt.
Sri Lanka is one of the clear examples of a third-world country that has turned into a battlefield for international financial organizations and regional and global superpowers. The country's vulnerabilities have made it an ample target for international financial organizations. These organizations are strictly prohibited from interfering in the political affairs of their client states. But in reality, they have turned into powerful political players with an aptitude to impact the economies of third world countries.
The International Monetary Fund and World Bank are international financial institutions and part of the legacy of Bretton Woods. Since 1944, the IMF and the World Bank have influenced the global financial order as two main intergovernmental organizations, and Sri Lanka has repeatedly interacted with both of these institutions. Now the country is facing critical conditions, including a shortage of food and fuel, power outages, and an insufficient supply of medical items and other goods. Privatization of state-owned enterprises and a shift to an export-based economy can provide Sri Lanka with sufficient foreign currency reserves, but implementing these policies requires overcoming pressure from powerful organizations. To escape the current crisis, Sri Lanka is appealing to regional superpowers to avoid its economic fallout. But by doing so, it has complicated its financial status and is now seeking aid from international organizations that force their own policies on poorer nations, disguised as harmless humanitarian assistance. United Nations assessment on World Bank policies has shown that this organization is, for most purposes, the World Bank is currently a human rights free zone. In its operational policies in particular, it treats human rights more like an infectious disease than universal values and obligations. This is how international financial organizations practice neocolonialism.
Now, to talk more on this, I would like to welcome Mr. C.P. Chandrasekhar. He's an economic columnist, a senior research fellow at the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts in New Delhi, India. First of all, welcome to the program, sir. Now, the extended fund facility is meant to resolve the issue of cash flow in Sri Lanka, but the question is cash flow the real cause of the problem?
Well, you know, the extended finance facility is supposed to be not just a cash flow issue. It's supposed to put in place a set of conditions reflected in a letter of intent, which the government concerns provides to the IMF. And we know the kind of conditionality associated with the IMF loans. And if you look at it in practice, what we have is $2.9 billion going into Sri Lanka as part of this agreement if it goes through the board. And what is known is that Sri Lanka's total outstanding debt stock is something like $51 billion. So $3 billion, even if it's going to come through, it's going to come through in a period over of you know, something like 3 to 4 years. And what you have is a large part of this $51 billion having to be paid off over the coming 2-3 years. So I wouldn't even say that this is an effort to resolve a cash flow. What it is really for the IMF to try and tell private financial investors that we are getting this country to adopt a set of policies which would be in keeping with what you think is appropriate. So we are de-risking the environment such that you will come in with additional cash or additional support, essentially, or not additional support, but additional lending. So unless there is a larger package in which not just bilateral lenders, but also private financial firms and bondholders of different kinds come in and work out a rescheduling exercise, it's not going to work. So I wouldn't even say that this is a cash flow adjustment. This is an adjustment. I mean, this is a process of de-risking the environment, or attempt at de-risking the environment for international private investors.
Sir, this is the 17th time that Sri Lanka receives aid from the IMF. At this point, we must ask, why do these programs keep failing in reviving the Sri Lankan economy?
So, yeah, that only sort of confirms what I've just said, that essentially, if you have a country which has, ever since the first IMF loan, adopted a set of policies which are in keeping with what the IMF wanted, it was a country which actually was performing quite well, particularly if you look at it in terms of the human development or welfare indicators. Sri Lanka was one of the developing countries across the globe, but definitely in the Asian region, in the Asia-Pacific region, which was performing really well. You take a country like that and put it through a transition, which is a neoliberal transition in terms of economic policy, and you end up with a situation where you don't really resolve the balance of payments difficulties of a country which, it is true, is dependent on a few sources of foreign exchange earnings. I mean, it's dependent on incomes from tourism, it is dependent on to a certain extent on garment exports, and it is dependent on remittances from Sri Lankan workers abroad. That if you have a few sources of income, obviously you're vulnerable. So instead of actually working on a strategy which would help that economy diversify in terms of its ability to be able to earn foreign exchange and diversify such that it can reduce its dependence on imports so that outflows of foreign exchange are lower, if you had a program of that kind, then you shouldn't have had a situation where they have to keep going back to the IMF, where actually you have these 17, I mean, this is the 17, you have 16 different instances in which they've gone. So I would actually say that the reason why the IMF keeps coming back, even though it's very clear that what it tried to do in the past is a failure, is because what it's trying to do is not really put the country on a trajectory which allows it to overcome its structural vulnerabilities and be to a certain extent sort of resilient vis-a-vis balance of payment shocks. But really what it aims to do is to create an environment in which there is a degree of confidence created for international investors to de-risk the environment for international investors, particularly for international lenders. It is in some sense getting the country caught in a debt trap, but in a way in which the losers will not be the international, you know, lenders who without due diligence have actually been providing large credits to many countries which are on the verge or actually have defaulted, like Sri Lanka has for the first time. That it really is de-risking these countries to say that you're not going to be the loser. If anybody is the loser, it's going to be, the population of the country, in particular, given inequality, the poor populations of these countries.
Sir, it's known that the IMF is notorious for its predatory lending policies that perpetuate financial troubles. So is another deal the solution that Sri Lankans should be seeking?
You see, the point is it's very clear in principle what a country like Sri Lanka needs at the moment, because it is true that it saw a collapse in its foreign exchange reserves because it has elements of balance payments vulnerability, and then a combination of the sudden stop in global economic activity, and particularly on the receipts from tourism, which came as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic and its aftermath and the response to the COVID-19 pandemic in terms of brutal lockouts or lockdowns all over the world, that it actually, because of that and because of the fact that post the Ukrainian invasion, it's the imports that it was dependent on, both of in particular of commodities like fertilizer, energy, etc., that the dollar prices of these went up quite sharply, it had seen a collapse in its reserves. Okay, so if that be the case, what we need is the following. It basically is a situation where Sri Lanka is saying that, listen, we've accumulated this debt. We are not in a position to be able to find the foreign exchange. It's not that you can print Sri Lankan rupees and meet your debt service commitments. You have to transform your Sri Lankan commodities or Sri Lankan rupees into foreign exchange, into hard currency, to be able to service this external debt. So what is needed is very clear. First, there is need for multilateral and bilateral creditors to actually examine the situation and write off a significant share of debt such so that it becomes feasible to be able to address the debt problem. Secondly, it's necessary for a large number of the private investors who have over a period of time bought into Sri Lankan sovereign bonds to accept a significant haircut, as well as allow for a degree of rescheduling. And third, since even if you manage to restructure and reschedule debt, that doesn't mean Sri Lanka's need for foreign exchange is going to vanish overnight. You need a process by which you could ensure the flow of concessional liquidity to Sri Lanka for a period of time. And finally, in that period of time, you need to put in place a strategy which, as I said, would diversify the economy such that the export earnings become larger and more sustained. And import earnings and import outflows are reduced by actually producing domestically a set of commodities, in particular food, which Sri Lanka tends to export over import over a period of time. So unless you have this whole package, some debt write-off, some restructuring of private debt involving significant haircuts and rescheduling, some degree of liquidity inflow in concessional terms to allow Sri Lanka over the coming, you know, couple of years or 3-4 years to tide over the difficulties it is facing. And finally, a non-neoliberal development package which allows it to diversify its economic structure so as to be able to reduce its import dependence and increase its export earnings. That is the only way in which you can actually resolve this without going in for another 18th, 19th, 20th or 21st IMF loan.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Chandrasekhar for being on the program. He's an economic columnist, a senior research fellow at the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts, New Delhi, India. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Andrew Fiddle Fernando, Colombo-based journalist and author of Upon a Sleepless Isle, slammed the IMF deal with Sri Lanka, stating the country's declining standard of living and costs rise compared to income. Ex-global youth worker and political activist Sankha Chandima Abaya Wardena asked for publishing of the complete Sri Lanka IMF deal, stating that people have a right to know. Joe Wallen, the Telegraph's Southeast Asia foreign correspondent, pointed to the Sri Lanka's borrowing complexities and added that if it is going to get to a sustainable level, Beijing, New Delhi, Tokyo, multilaterals, and global asset managers must all swallow losses.
And that was our episode about the unprecedented and devastating floods in Pakistan and the resulting crises. And also, Sri Lanka's attempt at receiving a loan from the IMF and its impact on the country's economy. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The holy prophet of Islam is the example
of عمل انسان بعد از ایمان.
Self purification is the most significant factor.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
امامت is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hojjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned.
آنتوان بارا نویسنده مسیحی سوری که در کویت زندگی میکنه
آنتوان بارا the famous Christian Lebanese author who lives in Kuwait traveled more than 7 times to the city of Karbala. He also attended once the Arba'in procession or walk to the city of Karbala. He has compiled 2 books about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. One book is titled Imam al-Hussein in Christian Thought, and his other important book is about Lady Zainab, titled Zainab, the Cry for the Continuation of Imam al-Hussein's Movement.
آنتوان برای مسیحی در این کتاب
Antoine Barra, in his famous book, Imam al-Hussein in Christian Thought, addresses the Shias and asks them not to limit the personality of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam only to the Shia world. He believes that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam belongs to all the people, regardless of their religion or faith. He also believes that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam belongs to all justice seekers and freedom seekers all across the world. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A grand jury has subpoenaed several associates of former President Donald Trump in connection with the Department of Justice's investigation into the origins of the January 6th Capitol riot. The Justice Department is looking into the Trump team's fundraising between the 2020 presidential election and 6th of January 2021 and how that money was used. That investigation is separate from the inquiry into the former president's handling of classified documents, which resulted in the FBI seizing material from his Mar-a-Lago residence last month. Stay with us for more. Britain's Guardian newspaper has this to say. Two of Donald Trump's top officials are facing subpoenas for an investigation against him regarding fundraisers following the 2020 elections that aimed to undermine the results of the election. Stephen Miller was once one of the former president's most senior aides, and Brian Jack, his former director of political affairs at the White House, were part of a large group of Trump officials and allies who were subpoenaed by the grand jury this week, according to a New York Times report. The current investigation is examining funds related to the Save America Political Action Committee, or Save America PAC, and an alleged plan that would entail sending fake electors to states that had contested results in the 2020 elections. The Save America Political Action Committee, or PAC, which was created by Trump in November of 2020, shortly after the election, is funded entirely by Republicans and currently sitting on more than $100 million in funds, up from $31 million in 2020. Stephen Miller, who attracted notoriety during Trump's administration for his alleged links to white supremacists and his staunch anti-immigrant stances, participated in a lengthy testimony earlier this year to the House Select Committee about Donald Trump's role in fanning the flames of the January 6 attack on the Capitol. Prior to that, in December, Brian Jack also faced a subpoena for his role in organizing a January 6 rally that led to the insurrection. Others on the list of the subpoenas issued this week include officials who were involved with the electoral scheme in various degrees, from junior aides to pro-Trump lawyers assisting in planning the scheme, as well as Republican lawmakers who are just Trump allies. While the subpoena doesn't put the individuals directly under investigation, it is an action that the Department of Justice can take against an individual in order to try to garner further information in a case, according to the New York Times. This week's subpoena is only the latest in a long string of allegations against an investigation of the former president. In the most recent episode, a raid in his Mar-a-Lago, Florida estate revealed he was in possession of documents he took from the White House during his departure in 2021. Documents that even senior Biden aides did not have the access to view. In response, Donald Trump last week chided the FBI and Department of Justice, accusing them of being vicious monsters under the control of the media and radical left scoundrels. CBS News has covered the story from a different angle. A grand jury has subpoenaed several associates of former President Donald Trump in connection with the Department of Justice's investigation into the origins of the January 6th Capitol riot. Multiple people familiar with the case told CBS News. It is not yet clear how many subpoenas were issued. The Justice Department is looking into the Trump team's fundraising activities between the 2020 presidential election and 6th of January 2021, and how that money was used. That investigation is separate from the inquiry into the former president's handling of classified documents, which resulted in the FBI seizing materials from his Mar-a-Lago residence last month. The Department of Justice's probe of the attack on the Capitol has accelerated over the last week. William Russell, a close advisor to Donald Trump, received a subpoena on Wednesday, 7th of September, related to the investigation. William Russell, 31, was often seen by Donald Trump's side, serving as the White House Deputy Director of Advance and Trip Director. He was with the former president for part of the day of the riot and moved to Florida to continue working for Donald Trump after his presidency. FBI personnel visited William Russell's Florida home for questioning on Wednesday morning, but he was out, according to a person familiar with the matter. Investigators later reached him by phone and served a subpoena via email. A lawyer for William Russell, Derek Ross, did not reply to a request for comment. William Russell, a Mississippi native, started working at the White House in 2017. A spokesperson for Trump criticized the investigation, claiming the Justice Department was attempting to intimidate the former president's supporters. "It will not work. Save America is more committed than ever to working for liberty, free and fair elections, equal justice under the law, strong borders, safe streets, energy independence, great education and more," said Liz Harrington, the spokesperson. The Business Insider has more details about the story. Two top former Trump advisors were subpoenaed this week as part of the Justice Department's expansive investigation into the events around the January 6th Capitol riot and beyond. Stephen Miller, a senior policy advisor during the Trump White House, and Brian Jack, Trump's political director, were among more than a dozen people in the former president's circle who were subpoenaed by a federal grand jury this week. Stephen Miller and Brian Jack did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The subpoenas appear to seek information on Trump's main fundraising operation, Save America, which was formed after the 2020 election and the alleged plot to overturn the 2020 vote by sending a slate of fake electors to contested states. On Thursday, the New York Times also reported that the Department of Justice is looking into the Save America PAC based on about a half a dozen subpoenas to lower-level former Trump aides, including Nicholas Luna and Ivanka Trump's chief of staff, Julie Radford. It remains unclear why exactly the Save America PAC is being investigated and how it might relate to the Capitol riot. The subpoenas for Stephen Miller and Brian Jack are also related to the Trump PAC, as well as the 2020 electoral scheme. On top of the ongoing probe of Trump's handling of official government records, the Department of Justice is investigating the Capitol breach, any obstruction of that investigation, and the fake electors' plot. Stephen Miller was subpoenaed by the House Select Committee investigating January 6th for his phone records earlier this year. The Trump advisor filed a lawsuit to block the subpoena, CNN reported. He previously sat for a deposition with the panel. Brian Jack, who still advises Donald Trump, was also subpoenaed by the committee last year.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. A child is like a white paper on which you can write good things or bad things. Entire personality of a child is developed by the parents, by the upbringing they do. And in this program, we try to provide all the necessary information that is required to bring up your child in the best possible way. The answers of your questions are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified Prajani. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University and researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, in our previous sessions, we have been discussing about the relationship, the domains of relationship. We discussed how we can detach a child from the digital world and develop his relationship with the environment. I want you to give a brief of the previous sessions, and now then let's move on to the next topics.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Supreme Absolute Being. We have been discussing the worldview that we as the followers of the faith should have. In this world of materialism, where it's very difficult to detach ourselves from the worldly attractions and things which keep us
busy
on the earth, basically, yeah. Yes?
The things that keep us busy all the time.
Busy all the time. Of course, we have to be busy all the time. But the important thing is, what is the intention? With what intention
are
we?
With what you're going to be busy,
yes,
with.
What are we targeting? And what do we want to achieve? And this is very important. Because when we, as I may have mentioned, that when we talk about the pure intention or sincerity in purpose, or we talk about the niyyah, it's not something that you just make when you're doing an action, when you're carrying out something. It's something which has a very deeper background in your mind. There's a whole worldview behind it. There's a whole ideology behind it. So therefore, we as human beings, and especially as parents, should know that what is our purpose and goal in life. What do we want to achieve?
Yeah.
And as we all say, that we want to achieve proximity to Allah Almighty.
True.
And I have been trying to define and to explain what does that proximity mean.
Yeah.
And proximity, of course, as we know, that it's not possible to gain a physical proximity to Allah Almighty, because He's not a physical entity.
Yeah.
So in what are we becoming close to Him?
True.
You're close to someone when you're a relative, you say you're close to him, or you live together, or you live close by, or some. And these are all physical things.
And now how you can get spiritually attached or close to someone, I'll ask you that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. We are with Professor Salman Nakavi, and we're discussing about Islamic upbringing, different topics, and Professor was discussing how we can develop spiritual relationship. Yes.
So basically, I've been emphasizing on the fact that we need to develop a relationship with Allah Almighty, and that is at two levels. One is at the level, at the higher level, which encloses it in it every aspect of our lives, and the special relationship which we have when we pray to Him, when we fast, when we go for Hajj.
Yeah.
And such rituals that we carry out on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, on a monthly basis, on a yearly basis. These are special acts, spiritual acts that we carry out, where we get charged, where we get rejuvenated, recharged spiritually. to remain spiritual in all other spheres of life also. Spiritually, our attachment with Allah Almighty is re-entrenched during these spiritual experiences that we have. But that means that it should permeate, this spirituality should permeate all other aspects of our lives. And the four relationships which we are talking about, under the faith in Allah Almighty, under this umbrella, in this spiritual attachment which we have, come the four relationships. And one of them is the special relationship with Allah Almighty, but also the other relationships which we have, especially with other human beings.
Okay.
And the first and foremost relationship which begins for a human being is his attachment with his parents, or the parents with their children, their offsprings.
Yeah,
that's his primary relationship with other human beings, which starts in this world.
Okay,
and especially for this relationship, we have to get prepared for ourselves. Number one, we have to establish that general relationship with Allah Almighty.
Yeah,
and that special relationship with Allah Almighty. And then, according to that worldview that we have, that we talk about, saying we need to become spiritually close to him, we need to become competent to manage our relations.
All right.
And becoming competent requires knowledge and skills and attitude, the proper knowledge and the proper skills, and also the proper attitude.
Yeah.
And this skills, knowledge skill set varies from various relations to from one relationship to the other.
To other relationship, yeah.
Yes. I mean, when you want to pray to Allah Almighty, that requires a special set of knowledge and skills.
Yeah.
When you want to deal with human beings, that requires another knowledge.
Set of skills and knowledge.
You can't say, look, I pray very nicely. I have a very good voice. When I pray to Allah, it's with sincerity. It's a beautiful voice, the best possible way. Mm-hmm. But that does not dispense with the fact we need to develop another set of knowledge and skills mm-hmm. to deal with our children.
All right.
So what is the knowledge skill set that we require for children? We as parents, we're going for it's a new challenge in our lives.
Yeah. You're trying to say that in order to develop these set of relationships, we first must have knowledge plus skills. Exactly. Knowledge and skills are must. Parents have to educate themselves towards these set of skills so that they can guide their children as well. I'll talk more on that with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "He who recites the Quran before puberty has indeed been given wisdom in his childhood."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. Professor said that we need to have those set of skills and knowledge ourselves as parents, and then only we can induce that to our children. Yes, Professor.
Yes, so number one, as I was saying, that under the umbrella of the general relationship with Allah Almighty, we need to become competent in every relationship, especially the relationship with our children. And for that, we have to develop the proper mindset. The world view that we have has to be very comprehensive. We have to understand that Allah Almighty, when He makes us become parents, when we come in, we're coming into that position, He is making us participate in the process of creation and creativity that He has for Himself. He is the supreme creator of everything. He has created the whole universe.
Yeah.
But then the universe has a certain system.
Yeah. set of rules.
Based on cause and effect.
True.
And everything doesn't happen out of the thin air. It happens according to a set of
rules
and laws.
Yeah.
And one of them is that the greatest creation of all, the human being himself, is himself a part of that creative process.
Yeah.
And so parents, by coming together, man and wife, are creating according to that system, according to that plan, according to that design.
Yeah.
They are becoming a part of that creation, that creative process. So that's a great, that's a huge, big honor for them. That Allah Almighty is giving them this
the
honor.
The opportunity.
Yes, the honor, the dignity, the position.
To be parents.
To be parents. Therefore, that's one thing that we have to understand. And when this human, the third human being, is coming to into
their
existence.
Their lives, yeah.
The person who is coming into this world, even before he or she is delivered out into this world, in the womb of the mother also, it is it's a living creature,
has its rights
and has to be taken care of.
Yeah.
So as a trust that Allah Almighty is entrusting us with. As a ni'mah.
Yeah. So we said that we gave a gist of all what we have said so far. There are relationships that need to be developed in a children that need to be developed in a child, and those relationships cannot be developed as such. For that, parents need to educate themselves with a set of skills, with a set of rules, and then only they can induce all those relationships, be that relationship with Allah, how to pray, how to act, how to go for fasting, be that relationship with their parents, be that relationship with other human beings, which we discussed in the previous sessions, or be that relationship with the environment, which is extremely necessary in these days because of the being attached to the digital world so much. Well, here once you said that now the parents have been honored with the parentship by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and now they have duties. Now, how parents can act as educators, we'll discuss that in another session, inshallah. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio or our official website, that's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanallah, God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.